Today, on this episode of the PeerDirect Special Spotlight,
let's discuss three really interesting abstracts from the 2026 ACC annual meeting focused on obstructive HCM. We'll cover multiple different studies looking at different myosin inhibitors and HCM with obstruction.
Today, Drs. DeFerry and Owens joined the podcast to discuss ACC 2026 highlights, new frontiers in myosin inhibition in this PeerDirect Special Spotlight. All opinions expressed are those of the presenters and do not necessarily reflect the views of this educational initiative's supporters.
Hello, I'm Dr. Alex DeFerria, Assistant Professor of Medicine in the Division of Cardiology at the University of Pennsylvania.
And I'm Dr. Anjali Owens, Associate Professor of Medicine and the Medical Director of the Center for Inherited Heart Disease at the University of Pennsylvania.
I'm happy to be here with you, Anjali.
Pleasure's mine, Alex.
Anjali, let's discuss three really interesting abstracts from the 2026 ACC annual meeting focused on obstructive HCM. We'll cover multiple different studies looking at different myosin inhibitors and HCM with obstruction. Why don't we start with SCOUT-HCM, which was presented as a late-breaking abstract and simultaneously published in the New England Journal.
Let's do it. So let me walk you through SCOUT, which was a fantastically new trial, the first time that we've seen a cardiac myosin inhibitor, in this case mavacamten, for adolescents with symptomatic obstructive HCM. As you know, prior to this trial, any adolescent with severe symptomatic obstructive HCM really required surgery for adequate symptom control. And this trial introduced the use of a cardiac myosin inhibitor in about 40 patients who were ages 12 to under 18 who'd had class 2 or 3 obstructive HCM. This trial was conducted versus placebo, randomized 1-to-1, with the primary endpoint of a change from baseline to week 28 in the Valsalva-provoked LVOT gradient. At week 28, we saw pretty remarkable results, with reduction in LVOT gradients down about 50 millimeters of mercury compared to placebo in the mavacamten group. And this was highly clinically and statistically significant. Also important with this new mechanism of action was that the adverse event rates were very similar and that no patient had a drop in their LVEF to below 50%.
That's remarkable. To think that now there's an option for children with HCM, whereas before the only thing we had was surgery, is a pretty big deal. And the impact taking a medication has on children long-term versus having to send them to surgery, it's really a game changer in that population.
Yes, as you know, some of the children diagnosed with obstructive HCM have the worst long-term prognosis. So if we can act early to relieve obstruction, we may really see a change in the disease trajectory in these patients. So as our next trial, why don't you walk us through the BHB-1893 molecule, which is another cardiac myosin inhibitor investigated in symptomatic obstructive HCM. Those results from their phase 2 study also presented at ACC.
So this is a next-in-class myosin inhibitor, and in this trial, it was a phase 2 looking at obstructive HCM. It was a multi-dose trial, so they were trying to figure out what the good dose would be to start patients in this group on. Patients were symptomatic, mostly NYHA class 2, but also class 3, and they all had obstructive HCM. Their resting LVOT gradients were at least 50 millimeters mercury, and they had an EF of at least 60%. There were three different dosing strategies that they tested over a 12-week period, two which were twice daily and once as once daily. And the primary endpoint was change in Valsalva-provoked gradient over the course of 12 weeks. What they found was that the LVOT gradients fell rapidly. Interestingly, some of these effects were seen within days of starting the therapy and sustained for weeks, up to 12 weeks of therapy. Specifically, in the group that was dosed either 40, 60, or 80 milligrams twice daily, 86% of those patients achieved an LVOT gradient less than 30 millimeters mercury, which is what we think of as the cutoff for statistically significant outflow tract obstruction. Patients showed gains in peak oxygen uptake, KCCQ scores, NT-proBNP levels, and improvement in their NYHA functional class. Specifically, the NT-proBNP declined substantially, with a greater than 80% achieving normalization. The mean LVEF reduction was minimal, normally around 1.8 to 2.7% decrease, and no patients had a drop in EF below 55%. Most adverse events were mild or moderate. Importantly, no serious adverse events or discontinuation or death was reported in the study. So Anjali, what do you think is the importance of yet another next-in-class myosin inhibitor being studied?
Yeah, it's really a growing class of medications, as you know. We currently have two FDA-approved myosin inhibitors for patients with obstructive HCM. That's the first-in-class agent, mavacamten, next-in-class agent, aficamten. Both of those agents require a REMS program by the FDA for safety monitoring, and that's to look at the ejection fraction by mechanism of action. We know that these drugs address hypercontractility that we typically see with HCM and make the heart more normal in terms of contraction and relaxation. The risk, of course, is that if you get too much of one of these drugs, your heart can become hypocontractile and the ejection fraction can drop. And because of that, we monitor over time with serial echocardiogram. The implications of another myosin inhibitor is, can we benefit by different drug pharmacologic properties such that we have easier on and off? So a change in half-life, onset of action, might that lead to easier dose, easier titration, and perhaps less of a safety issue? That's yet to be seen, but I think that's where our field is going with agents that modulate contractility, is can we make them safer and easier to monitor in the real world?
And that's a nice segue into our third topic, talking about dosing and how we do this in the real world. The third abstract we're going to talk about is clinical implications associated with temporary treatment interruption and reinitiation of aficamten in patients with obstructive HCM. So in the SEQUOIA-HCM trial, it was shown that aficamten improved exercise capacity and symptoms. And this analysis assessed what happens when the therapy is stopped. At the end of SEQUOIA, there was a washout period where they spent 4 weeks off drug and all of the patient's hemodynamics returned back to baseline with severe obstruction and their symptoms returned. Then, after the washout period, patients were enrolled into a long-term extension where they were put back on the medication and followed for another 24 weeks. The idea of a washout period is almost something that we could consider applying to patients in the real world when these drugs have to be stopped for any kind of procedure, whether they're non-cardiac or cardiac procedure. So the idea was, let's see what happens in the washout period and apply that to patients in the real world. They defined something called a rebound, which is any cardiac adverse event plus worsening in the gradient, as well as increase in the NT-proBNP or worsening in their symptoms. So all of these are markers that they're regressing in terms of their treatment. After stopping aficamten, Valsalva LVOT gradients returned to their baseline without evidence of excess rebound. Rebound criteria were met in one patient on aficamten and zero placebo patients. And in that single event in the aficamten arm, it was mild worsening of heart failure that they thought maybe was related to a drop in hemoglobin. But after restarting aficamten in the FOREST-HCM trial, patients had clinical improvements similar to what was seen in SEQUOIA when they were initially started on the drug. They had improvements in Valsalva gradients, markers of pressure in the heart with an NT-proBNP, their KCCQ improved again, and so did their NYHA class. So how do you think we can use a study like this to apply this in the real world when we're treating patients and real things come up and you have to think about stopping the drug?
Absolutely. It's a great question and has a lot of implications for the real world. As you know, in the REMS program for mavacamten, there's about 12,000 patients in the real world now on that drug. And with the recent FDA approval of aficamten at the end of 2025, we're seeing increasing number of patients on aficamten as well. And we get a call, oh, I would say at least once a week, of a partner or a colleague saying, do I need to stop this patient's cardiac myosin inhibitor for a colonoscopy or a non-cardiac procedure? And in the vast majority of cases, the answer is no. You can treat through a period of a procedure that's a non-cardiac procedure. You do need to let the anesthesiologist know that the patient's on a myosin inhibitor, and specifically to check for any drug-drug interactions that may occur with medicines that are given peri-procedure. For any cardiac procedure, in particular if a patient is undergoing cardiac surgery, it's important to stop the myosin inhibitor and let it wash out. And again, that's a frequent conversation that comes up in the real world. And you don't want to put a patient on cardiopulmonary bypass, for example, if they're being treated with a myosin inhibitor. With all new medications with a novel mechanism of action, it's great to know from the clinical trials that during the washout period, the patient goes back to baseline and that these are reversible medications. They have their effect when you're giving the drug, but when you stop the drug, the patient goes back to baseline and doesn't overshoot and have a rebound.
That's great discussion, Anjali. I think these abstracts really illustrate just how rapidly cardiac myosin inhibitor therapy is evolving. There's novel therapies as well as novel populations that we're trying these drugs in. And they're across the board improving LVOT obstruction, symptoms, and quality of life. And even thinking about how to use these in the real world is something that we're learning as we go. And I think that it's important that we talk about it because these questions are going to come up. And understanding how to safely integrate these drugs into clinical practice is important.
Absolutely. Taken together, these data really suggest that we're moving out of an area of nonspecific therapies and into targeted disease-specific management for hypertrophic cardiomyopathy. And that does allow our patients the opportunity to try a new pharmacologic therapy instead of going for an invasive approach. We need to see durability, and ultimately, we'd like to see whether or not these drugs are going to change the long-term trajectory of the disease. Thanks again, Alex.
And thank you to our audience for watching.
And that's today's Specialist Spotlight. Thank you for joining us for this episode of PeerDirect Medical News Podcast. For more stories like these, visit us at peerdirect.com. Thoughts, comments, or suggestions? Please leave us a review in your preferred listening platform or email us at editorial@peerdirect.com. Listen and subscribe on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. You can also download our Amazon Alexa Flash Briefing Medical News Roundup and just ask, "What's my flash briefing?" Thanks today to our guests, Drs. DeFaria and Owens. Join me next time for an episode where we'll cover the latest stories in the world of medicine.